Deadbeat Scroll by Mark Coggins is slick, sardonic, and suspenseful. Everything a great thriller should be, says New York Times bestselling author Lee Child. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 13. Arnie, Jewel. The next morning, I unlatched the security gate at the entrance to the Post Street apartment and stepped outside. Almost immediately, a divot materialized in the building facade just inches from my nose. There was no audible crack or report, so it took me a moment to realize I was being shot at. I crouched behind the gate as more shots whanged off its steel bars. I managed to fumble open the building's door and dive inside. There wasn't much doubt about who was flinging the rounds, since the gunman was obviously using a suppressor. I supposed Herr Doctor and his buddy were looking to eliminate the final witnesses, and I decided, belatedly, that it was time for some countermeasures. I walked well back from the door, parked myself on a lobby bench, and yanked out my cell phone. I didn't call the police. I was pretty sure Herr Doctor was long gone, and the only thing I'd have to show the cops was chips in a brick wall. So I called Ray, my neighbor in Palm Springs. He picked up on the third ring.
"I've been meaning to call you,"
he said in lieu of hello. His voice, like always, was high and reedy. "You have?" My voice, unlike always, was warbly. Near-death experiences have that effect on me.
"Yeah, but you first. What's on your mind?"
"I need you to ship my Luger and holster to me here in San Francisco." There was a long pause.
"Is that legal?"
"Shipping guns? Sort of. If you are a dealer or..."
"Don't tell me! I'd rather plead ignorance than operate with full knowledge of my crime."
"That's the spirit. I need it overnighted. Fastest delivery."
"Okay, but you're paying for it."
"Of course. Put it on my tab. And when you fill out the forms..."
"August, I'm not an idiot. I'm not going to list the contents as an illegal gun shipment."
Ray certainly wasn't an idiot. He was a retired aerospace engineer, and a damn good one at that. He was, however, a little lacking in common sense. "Of course not. Let me give you the coordinates." I dictated the address of the Flood Building office.
"I take it the gun is in its usual secure location."
"Yeah, under the bed."
"I'll get it out today."
He paused to clear his throat.
"You going to tell me what's going on?"
"My old partner, he was definitely murdered." It was surprising how hard it was to say it out loud.
"Do you know who did it?"
"I've identified a person or two of interest, but it's complicated."
"And dangerous, apparently."
"Yeah."
"You need me to come up and help?"
Although Ray was well into his eighth decade, it wasn't a question I took lightly. He and his electronic gizmos had saved my bacon several times before. "Thanks, Ray. I appreciate the offer. It's not your sort of thing. If circumstances change, I'll let you know."
"You do that."
"What did you have for me?"
"You got a letter."
I'd ask him to take in my mail, so the news wasn't exactly unexpected. "Ray, I may not be the most popular guy in the world, but even I get the occasional utility bill."
"It's not a bill, and it's postmarked from San Francisco."
"Who sent it?"
"It doesn't say, exactly. The only thing written in the space for the return address is CD.
I didn't have to think very long to figure out who that was. "Open it up," I commanded.
"I will. But I already know what's in it."
I heard the receiver being put down, then paper being torn. The clatter of metal followed. Ray picked up the phone.
It's a key.
Just a key? No paper? No note?
Nope.
Can you tell what kind of key?
It's a little small for a house key. Maybe a padlock?
How about a safe deposit box? Ray grunted.
No, there's no number stamped on it. And those are usually thinner and longer. No, it's a padlock key. Or maybe a locker key.
When was it sent?
4 days ago. Like I said, I didn't call you about it right away.
I let my head loll forward. Jesus.
It's from your old partner, isn't it?
It has to be, but hell if I know what it's for. I hung up after asking him to include the key in the shipment and went upstairs to scope out the street from the fire escape. If there was anyone still waiting to ambush me, I couldn't spot them. I eventually felt confident enough to slink out the front door again, and no bullets punctuated my arrival on the sidewalk. I hurried up Post Street until I got close enough to Union Square to find an honest-to-goodness taxicab and waved it down. I gave the driver an address on Broadway near Jones, a Russian Hill destination less than half a mile from Corinne White's house. I was heading to an appointment with Arnie Jewell, the beat expert Gretchen had located via Chris's internet search history. He lived in a blocky Victorian that had been chopped into several apartments. He was on the second floor, and when he greeted me at the door, it was clear he was even older than Ray. He had a laurel of white hair, a wispy white beard, and thin parchment skin marked with liver spots and spider veins. He wore a baggy gray cambric shirt and a pair of equally loose-fitting dress pants, cinched tightly at the waist. After I introduced myself, he said,
"You got some smudge on your nose if you care."
I brushed at my cheek and came away with pulverized brick grit, residue from my close ballistic encounter. Even though he had to be pushing 90 and peered through thick owlish glasses, Mr. Jewell had not lost his powers of observation. "Thanks," I mumbled. He led me down a corridor covered with paintings, posters, and photographs to a messy office lined with shelves that bowed under the weight of hundreds of books. On the top shelf, they were piled horizontally in layers that looked like sedimentary rock. In the corner of the room was an L-shaped desk with more piles of books and papers strewn across it. A manual typewriter sat on a desk pullout, and on the far side of that, a bamboo cane chair with a ratty cushion. Jewel eased himself into the cane chair and waved at a rocker gathering dust in the far corner. I pulled the rocker closer to him and sat down in it with a creak that was probably heard in Oakland. "Thanks for taking the time to see me."
"So your friend is dead,"
Jewel said without preamble. "Yes, but Gretchen told you that?"
"I wouldn't have agreed to see you if there wasn't a compelling reason. I'm tired of talking about the Beats. That's all anyone wants to discuss these days. My own work is completely ignored."
"You're a writer, too?" He waved vaguely behind him, then placed a mottled hand on top of a stack of books near the typewriter. All the books in the stack had his name on them.
"No, I just have a fetish for wood pulp."
"Sorry. If it makes any difference, the Beats have been dropped on my head. I don't have an intrinsic interest."
"Ask your questions."
"When did my friend come to see you?"
"A little less than a week ago. He was smart enough to position the visit as an opportunity to get a book signed. Only after we discussed my novel, which he'd actually read and appreciated, did he slip in some questions about the Beats."
"What did he ask?"
"I could tell he already had a good general knowledge. He was focused on the time in late 1951 when Jack Kerouac came to San Francisco to live with Neil Cassady and his wife Carolyn."
"I see." It must have sounded to Jewel like I didn't see much of anything.
"You don't know who Neil Cassady is, do you?"
"On a scale of yes or no, no."
"He's a major beat figure, and he was also associated with the 60s counterculture. Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters in particular. He had aspirations to be a Reiner, but he is best known as a sort of muse to Kerouac and Ginsberg. He encouraged Kerouac to adopt a more spontaneous writing style and served as a model for several of Kerouac's characters, including Dean Moriarty in Kerouac's most popular novel, On the Road.
Did you know him?
I knew most all of these characters. I went to school with Kerouac and Ginsberg at Columbia, and I met Cassidy in San Francisco through Ginsberg. He was crazy. He was always on, like one big twitching human nerve. It's no wonder he's remembered for encouraging spontaneity.
You said he had aspirations to be a writer. Did he actually produce anything?
He worked sporadically on an autobiographical novel called The First Third, but it wasn't published until after his death. The piece of prose he is best known for is a long letter he wrote to Kerouac during a 3-day Benzedrine high. It's been dubbed the Joan Anderson letter because it mentions a lover of his by that name. It's this letter that Kerouac credited as the inspiration for the style he used in On the Road and later books.
I fidgeted in the rocker, producing another discordant creak. Cassidy seemed like a bit of a sideline. I couldn't quite believe all this hoopla had been about him. What about Kerouac? I asked. What was he working on during the time of this visit? Late 1951, you said. Jewel nodded.
Late 1951 through the spring of 52. Your friend asked the same thing. It was a very productive time for Kerouac. He was basically being supported by the Cassidys. By Carolyn, actually, who was the only one of the three who had a paying job. Kerouac worked every day in the loft bedroom of the cottage the Cassidys were renting. He was still polishing On the Road, which wouldn't be published until 1957, and he also finished a draft of Visions of Cody, which was a sort of recapitulation and expansion of Road in an even more experimental style. Some of it is actually based on rap sessions with Cassidy he taped in the Russell Street house.
It almost slid by me like another widget on the assembly line. Wait a minute, Russell Street?
Yes, not far from here, on Russian Hill.
29 Russell Street?
That's right. Why?
The fickle finger of fate is trying its damnedest to get up my nose. Without mentioning her name, I gave him a brief summary of the search for Corinne White and my discovery of her body on the second floor of the house.
That can't be a coincidence,
said Jewel, finally seeming to develop an interest in the conversation.
That's right where Kerouac would have been working.
Is it possible he worked on something else besides On the Road in this Cody book?
Of course. His habit was to work on multiple projects simultaneously. Some of them were eventually abandoned, some weren't published until he was more popular, and a few of them didn't see print until he died. Visions of Cody, for instance, was published posthumously. Which book are you thinking about?
I ignored the question. I assume he wrote on a typewriter. Did he ever use long strips of paper taped together in a sort of continuous scroll? Jewel gave a strangled cough that managed to sound dismissive.
You really are a babe in the woods, aren't you?
What's that supposed to mean? He pushed the carriage of his typewriter to the left until the bell rang.
Yes, he often used a typewriter. Many of the writers of my generation did, and do. But Kerouac is famous for writing a draft of On the Road on a scroll of paper he scotch-taped together. He used rolls of architectural tracing paper, sometimes called bumwad because it's thin like toilet paper. You'll often hear that he used teletype paper, since Kerouac mentioned it on The Steve Allen Show, but he didn't. It was bumwad. He made the scroll so he could type continuously without having to change sheets. By the time he was finished, it was 120 feet long.
Does the scroll version of On the Road still exist?
It does. A collector owns it.
What's it worth?
The auction price in 2001 was $2.4 million. I'm sure it would fetch more than five today.
Wow. I looked past Jewel to the layers of tattered books along the wall. It was hard to imagine that a book, let alone a rough manuscript, could be worth that much. Then let me ask you this. If an unknown and previously unpublished Kerouac scroll were to be discovered, how much would it fetch? Jewel made a harumphing noise and took off his glasses. After several false starts, he yanked out a shirt tail to wipe the lenses, then set the glasses back on his face with a trembling hand.
Is this what this is about? You think you found a lost manuscript?
I think the woman I mentioned earlier discovered a manuscript while remodeling the Russell Street house, maybe in a wall of the bedroom Kerouac was using.
Why would he put it there?
I don't know. Maybe as a sort of time capsule? Maybe it was something he didn't want to come out when he was alive. Something controversial. Something too hot to handle.
I can't imagine anything being too hot to handle for Kerouac. That was what he was about, shaking up the establishment. Too hot to handle was all in a day's work for him. But if it is a legitimate manuscript, I'll wager it's a draft of an existing book. Does the work have a title?
The Beet Hive.
And how would you describe the content?
Honestly, as a bunch of mumbo jumbo. He chuckled dryly.
You wouldn't be alone in that assessment of Kerouac's oeuvre. Truman Capote famously dismissed it as not writing, just typing. But Kerouac definitely has a place in the American literary pantheon. On the Road is consistently listed in the top 100 novels of the 20th century. Can you give me a more specific impression? Like a lot of writers, Kerouac frequently changed titles of works in progress. While I confess I've never heard of The Beet Hive, it may be a jettison title for another book.
All right, but I only saw a few sentences. I described the stew of allegory, sex, gender-bending, collective living, and beeswax in the excerpt I'd read. Jewel combed his chin hair with his fingers.
Interesting,
he said at last.
You might be on to something after all. Kerouac and Cassidy were bisexual. Ginsberg was gay, as was Burroughs. They all slept with one another, and a number of them were involved in what we might now call polyamorous triads. For instance, Cassidy encouraged Carolyn to sleep with Kerouac. In fact, Cassidy tried to get them all into bed together, but Kerouac was too squeamish. That squeamishness didn't prevent Luann, Cassidy's first wife, from jacking both men off simultaneously while they were on one of their famous road trips.
He stared over at me like he was expecting some sort of reaction. Okay.
Furthermore, the Beats often lived together in communal quarters. They shared crash pads in New York, Denver, Berkeley, San Francisco, and even Paris. And there was a constant rivalry and jealousy between them. Ginsberg and Kerouac were jealous of each other's relationship with Cassidy, and both of them were critical of each other's work at times. Ginsberg could be the fag queen mentioned dismissively in the manuscript. All of them, with the notable exception of Cassidy, were distressed and tormented by their sexuality at some point in their lives. Kerouac, most of all.
So you're saying the writing I saw could have been inspired by real-life themes and events?
Without a doubt. If there was ever a writer to grind up his experiences to make a product, it was Kerouac. And more to the point, I have seen a reference to something like this. Not by this title, and not as something to be buried in the wall in a time capsule, but as Kerouac's utopian prescription for a better world. A better world where he would no longer be ashamed and tormented by his sexuality.
You say reference. Are there any known copies of the book itself?
No, The only mention I'm aware of is a fragment of a letter from Kerouac to Cassidy. Most of the letter was lost, but Carolyn, who lived the longest, retained a page. Kerouac describes a novel of his that will show the world that the true meaning of beat is beatific, and as you suggested, he makes clear that it's something for posterity, for future generations. Most beat scholars assumed it was a project Kerouac never started or abandoned early on. He had plenty of those in his career.
I thought of Finger Hut. Would someone like a rare book dealer be aware of the book, or the possibility of a book on this topic from Kerouac?
Maybe. It would depend on how much the dealer specialized in beat literature. This is pretty inside baseball.
If it existed, would this thing be as valuable as the On the Road scroll?
You're really stuck on this value question, aren't you?
Humor me. Jewel turned to the typewriter and repeatedly pressed the spacebar. The carriage bumped along with a staccato vibration.
If it were finished,
he said without glancing up,
and if it were written in the late 40s, early 50s, when Kerouac did his best work, it would be quite valuable, both as a collector's item and as a new work to be published. No doubt, many current-day beats would see it as a sort of holy text, a prescription for living.
He took his finger off the spacebar and looked me in the eye.
But if you're wondering if someone would kill for it, the answer is yes, decidedly yes. To the right sort of person, or the wrong sort, murder would be a small price to pay.
You have been listening to The Deadbeat Scroll, a book the New York Journal of Books described as a glorious potpourri of violence, black humor, sex, and a hunt for a lost manuscript. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.